Opinions expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the management of Louisville.am and Veritas New Media, a Louisville.am production. From the heart of the Highlands in Louisville, Kentucky, this is the Startup Podcast. My name is Dan Vonderhyde. Thank you for joining us this week. It's another hour speaking with Louisville entrepreneurs, something I've been doing for almost a year now. These guys have working on projects, guys and gals, I should say, working on projects, trying to get them off the ground, building companies, building things, and we learn from their successes and their failures. This week, a guy I've been trying to connect with for a long, long time. It's Keith Ringer. He and Chuck Burke fired up Louisville Mojo back in the mid-2000s, I guess it was. They were early in on the social networking thing and ended up selling that thing off. And so Keith and I talk a lot about his experience with Louisville Mojo and why it didn't scale and the raising of the money of Louisville Mojo and what happened with the economy and all of that stuff. Well, he's working on a couple of new projects, and we touch on that as well. Keith is a super smart guy. Anybody that sits down and talks with him is better off at the end of the conversation. So he tells you how to get a hold of him as well. There's a new Velocity Southern Indiana class they just fired up here the past couple of weeks. I've been over there and met a couple of them. I have several scheduled to appear on the podcast in the coming weeks. So there's a lot of stuff going on. We were mentioned in a Forbes article this week. We had a little blurb about Louisville becoming a startup spot of note. They mentioned Cleveland and Pittsburgh and St. Louis, and so the Midwest has things happening, man. It's funny, Keith talks about that a little bit in our conversation, and you might be surprised by what he says, so make sure you stick around to the end to hear that. I can't believe I didn't mention that before. And so anyway, the Velocity guys are coming up in the next couple weeks. If you are a podcast fan, you like what I'm doing here, and you like what we're doing on Louisville.am, and you like to drink beer, and many of you do because they have the open beer thing on Fridays, you gotta tune in. That's such an old radio thing. Subscribe to the LouisvilleBeer.com podcast. Those guys are hilarious. They come in here every week with a giant cooler full of craft beer and leave a giant mess behind. But I like them, so I let them slide on that stuff. Even though some of the keys on my keyboard are sticking a little bit, that ain't cool, man. But if you're a beer fan and you like to enjoy what you're drinking, LouisvilleBeer.com podcast is great. You can pick it up at Louisville.am. You can pick it up on iTunes. You can pick it up on their blog at LouisvilleBeer.com. So it's something I highly recommend. Let's get started with a smart guy in town. It's Keith Ringer right here on the Startup Podcast. It's not like you're on The Tonight Show or something. Do people still watch The Tonight Show? I guess it's not like you're on Conan.
I quit watching TV.
Altogether?
Basically, yeah. I still watch Netflix sometimes, but that's about it.
Hold that and talk directly into it.
Sorry. How about that?
All right.
Do I sound taller?
You sound... Yes, you do, as a matter of fact.
Awesome.
Crazy how that works out.
I'm going to take this with me.
I don't... You know what? The truth be told is I don't watch a lot of broadcast television anymore. I do love Conan's monologue every night at 11, and then I'll shut the TV off after that. But I just live on Netflix.
There's a bunch of good stuff on, I'm sure. I'm not saying there's not. I just feel like I have too much to do, and most of what I want to see I can get from a laptop or whatever.
Do you spend your evenings in front of a computer working on things?
Yeah, breaking it up between trying to get some exercise, playing with the kids, and on the computer, yeah.
Oh, wait a second. Exercise, that's what I've been leaving out of my... That's why I'm sitting here all twisted up like a pretzel today with lower back pain. It's awful.
It's what I figured out during the Mojo insanity, that you actually can't sustain yourself just by working really hard all the time.
Yeah.
You have to unplug.
Especially because this is such a sedentary life that I've found myself in.
Yeah.
I sit in this studio all day, or I sit at home banging out a website or whatever it is.
For most of us in tech.
That's terrible.
Yep.
But, all right. We do have a podcast on the network, the VO2 Multisport.
Mm-hmm.
I sit in here with that guy once a week, and they talk about all these great ways to work out and equipment and how exhilarating it is. And I want to do it so badly.
I love it because working out and the NBA or going to school or whatever, both of those things are on this trajectory to 7 minutes, just 7 minutes a day. You can be fit and have an MBA for 7 minutes a day or whatever, right? Like, it's all going down this path of you can do almost nothing and get these great benefits. But I don't know if I think it's true, but it's fascinating to see it all move in that direction.
All right, all right. We're getting way – we're not even on topic yet.
Oh, sorry.
What's the 7 minutes?
There's some article in the New York Times recently, the wellness blog. It's the seven-minute, you know, like hardcore intensity workout or whatever. It's 7 minutes. Seven minutes a day and you're fit.
I'm thinking of there's something about Mary when a guy says, I just invented seven-minute abs. He goes, no, but there's already eight-minute abs. He goes, no, this is seven-minute abs.
that's pretty much the whole thing.
If I spent 7 minutes a day on my abs, I would probably not be twisted up like a pretzel, admittedly.
So. Just on the abs, yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be great, 7 minutes.
Generally, I have conversation starter questions, but I got here about 5 minutes before you did, so I don't have those typed out.
Okay.
So we're just going to wing it today.
Let's do this thing.
Let's talk about, before I turned the microphone on, we were talking about your education, which was philosophy at U of L and then an MBA from U of L?
Yep.
Okay. And I guess I shouldn't have asked that as a yes or no question.
I started out, so philosophy, I didn't really mean to be a philosophy major. Well, I certainly didn't when I started undergrad. Went through five or six different majors and had to take a like an intro to philosophy course as a general ed requirement and loved it.
I got like 102% in philosophy.
Yeah.
And I took philosophy 102 and I hated it.
Really?
I don't know. I was just a lazy college kid for, you know.
Well, I was too, and that was actually the turning point for me. I changed my major at the end of that class to philosophy and took, I don't know what, 2/3 of my remaining credit hours in a very compressed amount of time because I had such a passion for it.
Yeah.
And when I got out, I actually meant to go back and get a PhD in philosophy, but I was working at that point full time in a business and realized I don't know that much about business and just ended up sort of finding the MBA program as a concept and then finding IMBA, the integrative MBA at U of L, mm-hmm. is focused on entrepreneurship, and got accepted to that, not quite halfway through that and realized cohort groups, that's not my thing.
Yeah.
Or basically anything social.
Yeah.
So I switched to the trad program and still was sort of on a fast track to graduate. Well,
do you think that you were attracted to philosophy because of the logic of the whole thing? Like, things have to make sense in your head?
Yeah, I think so. The logic of it, I was a religious studies minor. I've always been into sort of causal source, trying to understand what came before.
The meaning of life.
Yeah, that type of.
Let's just call it what it is.
The meaning of life.
Yeah.
So it was all fascinating to me. And there were great professors, you know, still are as far as I know over there for the philosophy program. So it was a good experience. I wouldn't change it.
Okay. Yeah. But that it spoke to you, the left side of your brain, I have to assume.
Yeah. I mean, I'd still like to go back and get a PhD in philosophy. I just now, you know, today I don't have the time. We end up right now 42 years old. So
7 minutes a day, you two.
7 minutes a day, I can get a PhD in philosophy.
Good golly. All right. So you get out, and what year was that, a straight track? Like, you started college at 18 and then you got out after your master's at 20,
oh.
What, 25?
No, I actually...
You left a bunch of stuff out, Keith.
Yeah. Well, I started college at 18 and immediately failed out. And then went and got a job traveling and lived in a number of other places.
Okay.
And came back to Louisville and sort of got my stuff together.
So I
graduated.
Like, you traveled the world?
Not the world. Okay. I traveled the U.S. and I did live in Condado, Puerto Rico for a while, which I guess is still the U.S., but it was slightly more exotic.
You got a different perspective on things.
A little bit of a different perspective.
Okay.
And I was able to sort of reel myself in and get some, you know, develop some discipline.
By that time, you were what, 20?
Yeah, early 20s. I came back and sort of settled back into school. And then when I graduated, I think I took 2 years working in sales before I went back for the MBA.
Okay.
Sort of what, and my takeaway during that period was, you know, I really enjoy selling. I still do a lot of it, obviously, on a day-to-day basis. But I wanted more. I wanted to be in control of a company and able to influence decisions around product and approach and, mm-hmm. you know, all of those things that you, if you're just in a pure sales position, you usually don't have a lot of control of.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And but I guess what was your first entrepreneurial venture then? Was it Mojo, or was there something before that?
It would have to be. It would have to be age nine.
Okay, we're yeah, lemonade stand. Or
we would go over to the side of Crescent Hill Golf Course and gather up all the golf balls that were over the fence in what used to be some woods, and then we'd go to the ball washer, wash them, go back and sell them, walk around on the golf course and hawk them all day long.
That was smart.
All summer is good money. It's good money for a 9-year-old.
I'll bet.
Yeah, and then
how many times did you get hit?
Not at all. Okay, fortunately, good. I had some close calls, and I think
probably easy for to dodge. You seem to be pretty nimble.
I am. I'm spatially efficient.
That's right.
So I have that going for me. I'm pretty durable too. But
so, okay, so that just I mean, you figured that out on your own. Like, oh my gosh, there's something here we can sell.
It's like found money. They're just laying everywhere.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Well, see, that's trying to get to the heart of things. Where does the drive come from for somebody who wants to do their own thing? Is that born in, or is that something that, like, did you get that from your parents, or what's the...
Well, my mom has been an entrepreneur for all of my, easily since before I turned a teenager, right? She started her own business, and I've seen her go through a couple different iterations of her venture. She's a consultant. So seeing that firsthand is probably really valuable, but I don't think anybody has to see that to realize that they want to be more in control of their destiny, which is what I wanted out of it, right? Or I realize that now. At the time, I would have said, oh, I want more money, or I want X, or I want a more flexible schedule, but well, it all comes down to being in control, right?
I guess so, for some people.
For me, it does. Well,
you're in control of your money, and you're in control of your schedule, and so it all feeds. It's like a puzzle.
Yeah.
It all fits together.
And then apparently when your business gets big enough, you start to give up control to it again. So it's this vicious cycle. But I haven't suffered from that fate.
So where does the internet feed into all of this? You and Chuck were internet early adopters or innovators or whatever. You guys were early on the scene when all of that stuff started to take off. So.
Yeah, like Chuck
we're about the same age. So I didn't see the internet coming because, again, I was a lazy college kid and I wasn't paying any attention. But
I wasn't paying attention to the internet, and I didn't like the idea of I had no interest really in IT as a broad field or computers generally until the internet came around. It was the network, you know, that changed everything for me.
Okay.
Chuck, on the other hand, was super on task and had been working on that since a young age. Okay. So we met at 13 years old, I think, at Manual. We were both accepted to the magnet program at Manual. Mm-hmm. And he was in the computer science, information technology track. And I was in just the plain old, smart kid school or whatever. So they kicked me out, though, because they figured out I was a sham. So
probably too smart for it. That's the problem.
If skateboarding at U of L all day is your idea of too smart, then I was way too smart for them. So I was not on task. But Chuck was, and, you know, so he really grew through the whole. His first programming job was 13 or 14 years old at the time, Store Cable, and he really followed it through these various iterations of, you know, it's big computer, it's a little computer, everybody can have a computer, now computers are networked or whatever, and took it to that. And he was at that point pre-Friendster, actually, where he was thinking about these different components that now we generally refer to as social media. Mm-hmm. So he was really very much at the forefront of that, in my opinion, in thinking about it and recognizing the opportunity. And I was, to the extent that I thought there was a way to monetize it, but on the technology side, I wasn't. I was sort of, you know, predatory in a lot of ways, not toward him, but just, you know, to take the concept and monetize it.
So you you have a sales background then.
That's right.
So you just knew how to logically put together the concept of audience as a product, which, I mean, it was a different type of audience, though. It's not like the traditional old newspaper, radio, TV, where you're just, you know, spewing out information to people. They were actually communicating on your platform. So,
you know, it's hard to explain it in context now. In 2003, how foreign the idea of social media as a viable ad product was, or as an ad platform, or whatever you want to say. lots of people don't like it when you abuse the term platform in the software industry, so I have to be careful. But anyway, as a mechanism for reaching people and communicating a branded message, in 2003 and 2004, when we started trying to, you know, productize what we were doing and sell it, it was a very unpopular notion. And literally people, you know,
with advertisers or with users?
With advertisers.
Okay.
No, the users were really open-minded to what was going on, I think, because we did a good job most of the time of pairing, you know, the advertisers self-select, right? Mm-hmm. So pairing them to the interests of the users. That was easy. We had Brown Foreman and, you know, we Maker's Mark, and we had lots of things that young folks could be interested in or whatever. And I just said young folks.
Young folks.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Welcome to middle age.
You know how you know how you get old and then you say young folks and you realize you just did it? Ah.
I think I don't want to say it. I was shaking my head at something earlier today. You know, you go on the internet and you see there are generational differences.
Yeah.
And I don't I don't like it. I don't like that now all of a sudden I'm not the younger generation on the planet.
Yeah.
Where there are other people that are younger and they have different ideas and they do things differently and I want to know what those things are, but I also I'm 42. I know what I like.
I'm sorry, I just totally missed that. I had to Snapchat. So.
Oh.
Yeah, so.
What is that? I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. So we may be jumping ahead. I sort of want to cover the arc of Mojo.
Yeah.
We can compartmentalize that a little bit or compress it, because I do want to talk about what you're doing. Like, you built some sort of greenhouse or something.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get there. But, okay, so 2003, 2004, you guys have built this method of communication, person to person, so to speak.
Yeah.
What was around at the time? Was Friendster? Was LinkedIn? LinkedIn was in.
Friendster. LinkedIn launched at some point in there. Spoke was actually software called Spoke, and I think it still exists in some form, was the threat at the time on the business side. Let's see, MySpace launched a month before Louisville Mojo went live. Facebook launched a month after Louisville Mojo went live.
All right.
So it was really an emergent time for that stuff. There was no Twitter, Pinterest, anything like that, right, as we think of it now.
I remember, I think I may have mentioned this on the podcast before. I was selling radio for Clear Channel, and I came across a guy who was a fellow Ball State graduate, which is why I think, I don't know where we connected, but I drove up to Indianapolis and spent the day with this guy, and he started this thing called It's Not What You Know, It's Who You Know.
Okay.
But he had it abbreviated to IKY, you know, he made up a word.
Whatever proper acronym.
Right. He acronymed that thing down to six letters or something, and it was LinkedIn, essentially.
Okay.
And look, in hindsight, I'd love to find that guy and talk to him again. I can't remember his name. He's up in Indy somewhere doing something. But when all of this stuff started to pop, it's like, oh, my gosh, that's exactly what that guy was talking about. And I thought it was such a great idea. And here I just wanted to sell him ads. You know, that's I am really illustrating my short-sightedness today. Like, hey, maybe this guy will buy some radio time. You know,
got to go with what you know.
But I was younger. I was, you know, anyhow. All right, so we're 2003, 2004. You guys start to monetize a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Were you working full-time on it at that point, or were you...
Well, it was interesting, and it's the way that the transition worked so well. When I got out of grad school, well, actually, the beginning of my last semester in undergrad, I left my full-time... I was working full-time, going to grad school full-time, and I left that job to start my own business, which is just sort of like a marketing, you know, consultancy effect, and doing some
really...
Were
you single at the time?
No, I was married, but I didn't have kids yet.
Okay, all right. That's an important point for a lot of people thinking about doing their own thing.
Yeah, it's all much more complicated once you have the kids.
Sure it is.
So, yeah, so did that, and I was already on my own, and Chuck had a wholesale software development company already. And the way we connected is I was selling a bunch of stuff that I couldn't build in-house, and he didn't have anybody selling.
Oh.
So I ended up selling projects, and he was building them, and it was just sort of a mutually, you know, symbiotic relationship or whatever, but we didn't have any structural relationship as far as a company. Okay. And then he called me up one day and said, check this out. Louisville Mojo, put this up. It's going to be awesome. You know, I go to the site. I'm like, this is pretty cool. What's the angle? And he's like, well, people are going to see this and see our mad web dev skills. And then, you know, business is going to be lining up. And I was like, well, that's completely, you know, hairball. That's not going to work. That's a bad idea.
People, it requires people to talk to each other.
Well,
you don't know, you know, Chuck, people don't like to talk.
The user on, not that it wouldn't take off, rather that the buyer,
oh, gotcha,
that, right, the buyer of a web system that he was selling, like he was selling to GE and
okay,
he was selling to the Department of Defense. I mean, he had some big customers that he was doing, you know, relatively smaller projects for big customers. Creative Alliance and Kentucky Lottery and stuff like that. So these folks, the buyers for these projects, didn't have the disposable time or the interest in being on Louisville Mojo. So the buyers that he needed, you know, weren't in the right space, the wrong demographic,
gotcha,
for his angle.
Okay.
And that's when we said about, hey, how do we monetize it? What's the angle? And finally, after we wrote a little joint venture agreement. It was a 6-month test. And it had these benchmarks. It was one or two pages. It had these benchmarks. We're going to do this over the next 6 months and then reassess.
So you guys, you're probably 30 at this point?
Yeah.
30?
Yep.
So you've known each other since you were 13, but you still took the time to get it on paper.
Well, we had known each other, and then we didn't see each other through undergrad or grad school. So we had, you know, fallen out of contact.
Okay. All right.
So we had this sort of basic level of familiarity, but I would say you enter business with someone, that's a totally different level of trust. You know, we used to have all the employees tested for personality, style, and stuff like that. We did it ourselves, and we both have really low trust, right?
Okay.
So it's a good thing to know about yourself,
yep,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we went into it. We wrote it down. 6 months later, we decided it's time to get together, read the agreement, reassess. You know, and we're sitting across from the table from each other, much like you and I are, and we read this thing in total silence, and my heart just drops. Because I had decided this is my future. Like, we have to go for it. This is, okay. And we didn't hit a single one of the benchmarks.
Oh, wow.
So it just completely was, you know, it was just a bomb, except that we both were caught up in it. And
it was
almost
fun. You didn't hit the benchmarks, but you were clearly doing something that was fun and it spoke to you.
Yeah, so absolutely.
That, okay.
And I didn't know yet quite how Chuck felt about it. I mean, we'd been engrossed in it, but I didn't know what was going on inside his head or his heart. So we read this list and, you know, my heart just dropped. And my voice was cracking. I was like, so what, how do you think it's going? And he's like, I think it's going friggin' great. You know?
Okay.
And I'm like, we need to start a company. And he's like, heck yeah. So
oh,
that was
nice.
It. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we really, and that was my, you know, got a bunch of takeaways, right? You can learn a lot from a failure, I think. But one of them was you need a good partner. Right? And it's just amazing how somebody can carry you through when you aren't 100%. So.
So you didn't measure those benchmarks from day one to day 60 or whatever it was? I don't know.
We had been...
I mean,
we didn't have the business model canvas working.
Gotcha.
Okay. We were taking, you know, although quite honestly, what was going on was disaster because the site was originally not meant to scale. It was built in an Access database. Right. And nothing about what had been built really was meant to scale the way that it did. So within a matter of months, we had over 1 million page views a month.
Yeah.
Within a year, we were serving over 10 million page views. In 18 months, we were serving more traffic than the Courier Journal.
Yeah.
You know, so at that time, we had benchmarks and notes, but it was really about putting out fires. So
what, man, I should have just scheduled it. I have the two of you in here at the same time to really dig into the Mojo story.
Oh.
Chuck sat in that chair before, by the way.
Too. Okay.
It's for a different podcast. But, I mean, you had Louisville Mojo and then you bought several other city.coms.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. City this
Mojo
awesome com. Domain portfolio.
Yeah. Would you, if you had to go back and do it all over again, would you have found a more generic term and tried to scale up like that rather than, think maybe that was
the Mojo
the problem?
No, I don't actually. The Mojo term didn't bother me at all. The biggest problem sort of fundamentally was, you know, and I'll give credit to, the Zuck. There are people that saw what was going on with social networking and imagined grandparents having accounts.
Okay.
You know, and we didn't have that vision.
Hmm.
And so we never really got great traction outside of Louisville. We had two or three or four sites that had good traffic, but not great traffic.
I've seen an IndieMojo.com bumper sticker before.
Yeah.
I make it up there every now and then.
So. They did a great job, IndieMojo, and we had we had a bunch of incredible employees, and we had two or three that were just superstars, and everything they've done since has been, you know, gold. And we had a guy named Ryan Hupfer in Indy running that site, and he did an awesome job. And he's out in the valley now making a living.
Oh, really? Okay, nice.
Yeah, so.
You have good coaching pedigree in that case.
Oh, I think he was
just Bobby Knight.
I think he was just a superstar. Yeah, no, I think he was just a superstar, and we were lucky enough to have him. I'm not sure. One of the other things I learned was that I'm not a good people manager, actually. So
really?
Yeah, which is a good thing to know, right? So I think running a business and making some of those leadership decisions, that's different than managing people day to day. Or being that point of contact.
Yeah.
And so what I found was
was all said and done and you guys sold everything off, then you're like, maybe I shouldn't manage people. Like, when did that occur?
No. It was very early in the life of the business.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
We had to let someone go, and he started crying at the interview, and I almost just reached over and smacked him, right? And I'm like, I need to be more empathetic. Like, there are all sorts of qualities of a manager that I lack. I'm trying to do something punitive here. Will you please stop crying?
Yeah. So. Well, I thought you were going to say you felt so bad for him that you kept him on. He said, "Okay, just look, we'll just give it another try here."
That would be my partner at the time, who was more sympathetic to folks.
But, okay.
No.
All right.
And that's not mine.
All right. So then you guys progressed along, and you made a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And you bought. I remember when I spoke to you once, you had bought the office building that you were in over on Brownsboro? Is that
right? Bought one over on Frankfurt Avenue.
Frankfurt Avenue. Okay.
Yeah, over in Clifton Lofts.
Things are humming along, and you took a big chance on the editorial department.
Yeah.
I don't want to call it the swan song, but that was a really big chance that you guys took from a investment standpoint.
It definitely was, and I wish that we had done that sooner. Mm-hmm. I actually think that it would have worked if we had given it more time to simmer. And I think if the economy hadn't tanked, it would have, you know, worked. Because
I completely forgot about the timing of all this.
Yeah, the timing was just abhorrent. It couldn't have been any worse, you know, in that regard. And we couldn't have, or we didn't see it coming. I'd say we probably couldn't have, you know, but this is when Sequoia's sort of rest in peace, you know, restinpeace.com slide deck came out, and it was like the investment world just sort of, you know, turned their back. So at the point when we needed a little bit more funding and a little bit more runway, we were 75 days from break even cash flow when the economy started to tank, when you saw the market shift down and it didn't, you know, then recover for a few years. So, it was just really, it was unfortunate in that regard, but I mean, there are plenty of startups that made it too. So clearly that wasn't everything that happened. That was just one of the dynamics.
Well, you know, you had just taken a step that took you, I would say, out of the lean category because you went from all 100% user generated to, you know, you have people that you have to pay to write stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that was just unfortunate timing. Mostly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there was a lot to it. And you know more of the history than a lot of people. You know a lot about strategically what we were working on and what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And not everything fell into place with the news initiative. So obviously, it probably could have turned out. It probably could have gone a different direction. But it is what it is. I've got very few regrets. Certainly, anything related to Mojo's, I don't regret it.
What was the toughest thing? Well, you already said managing people was not your strength, but
yeah.
Like what's the hard lesson you learned through all of that?
Well, to have a bigger vision for what's going on.
Yeah, you raised plenty of money. Did you not? I mean, well, so I mean, you at least had some vision.
We raised $1.5 million.
Okay.
You know, but
to a lot of people, that's plenty of money.
Yeah. Well, maybe it should have been, but we were competing against, Facebook.
Yeah.
And we were competing against everybody that came up during that period of time, and none of them that made out, none of them that sold, you know, had raised less than $50 million.
Okay.
You know, but it was High Five and at the time Plaxo and, you know, LinkedIn, and we just, you know, MySpace. I mean, We spent all our time being worried about MySpace and not Facebook, right? Facebook wasn't a player for years.
Yeah.
So
tell me about the process of raising money. And I would say that somebody that can raise $1.5 million is good at it. At least you have some skill there.
We had a great story. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what about how were you received initially? I mean, does Kentucky in general have a good atmosphere for?
I would say no, but the sort of shining light is KSTC and some of those related organizations. You know, they really gave us a lot of credibility with their funding and their contribution to the larger round that we did. They'd actually done sort of a seed round through, I think it used to be called the Gap Fund, and I think it's something else now. But anyway, they have various funds, and at the time they had this incentive for technology companies that gave us a springboard and gave us a lot of credibility when we started talking to investors. Chris Kimmel and Vic Chadha and Sean O'Leary, not Genscape Sean O'Leary, but KSTC Sean O'Leary, had a tremendous amount of faith in us early on, and that carried a lot of weight with people.
Okay.
And then shortly after that, Bruce Lunsford got involved, and of course, you know, among investors in the state, I think he carries a lot of weight too. So we just, maybe in some ways we sort of lucked out, but there was a lot of hard work too, right?
So, and now all of that came to an end at what point?
You mean sort of when the party's over, like Mojo, we've got a seems like it was late 2009, it was clear that the path we were on was not viable, right?
Okay.
In 2010, we sort of pulled out all the stops and did a lot of different things. And then, you know, and it wasn't clear that it wouldn't be a viable business. It was clear that the business wouldn't look anything like we thought it would.
Okay, because the audience, I guess they probably sort of went away to a certain degree.
We were losing audience to Facebook at some point in, you know, in 2000.
But there was still an audience there, meaning you still had a product.
Yeah.
That was, you know, you could make some money off of.
Yeah. The, I think that, you know, the challenge was, here's what happened. We were, I mean, to be just perfectly blunt about the numbers, we were at break even about a month and a half before we were going to really be able to cover our own expenses. Our revenue got cut by two-thirds on a monthly basis, right? It went away.
Advertisers dropped off.
Yeah, just advertisers. Some of them actually closed. Some of them just quit paying their contracts or their bills. Some of them, you know, canceled and just paid it off, you know, the ones with more financial wherewithal. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it was a lot of money that, you know, and at that point, we had been scaling up cost to match.
Yeah.
And we had been really trying to grow the business as quickly as possible. So it was a tough spot.
And then, all right, 2010, you sold it, right? Somebody buy it?
Well, we did, but I mean, it was a fire sale. But
I get it. But you're out at that point. You're like,
oh,
so then
But
you look around like, oh, well, that was fun. It was exhilarating. I'm glad to be out of it. What do I do now? Like, what did you do?
Well, the very hardest thing for me was coming to terms with the fact that, well, the two hardest things were letting great employees go, right?
Yeah.
I let go of people that weren't a fit with the company. They weren't doing their jobs, or, you know, we couldn't find a way to work it out. But that's different. That's always the right reason to let someone go. So letting people go that were doing a great job and we just couldn't pay them, that was horrible. So that was the first very difficult step in recognizing party's over. And then the second one was realizing if we can't, you know, if the software assets don't have significant value, we can't make a lot up to the investors, and now I've let them down too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So both of those things were really difficult. But then, you know, a couple people pulled me aside. In fact, people that had put money into the business and said, hey, you have to worry about yourself. You have to worry about your family. Everybody else is going to be okay. Everybody else that was involved, you know, they're big boys and girls. So, and that sort of, you know, snapped me too. Hey, I've got to worry about my own life for a little bit. So I had three really interesting opportunities at that time. One of them, I had a conversation with Kentucky Highlands Investment Corporation, which is like Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation, except more geared toward the counties in eastern Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And they have a project with UK called HBEER, or Houseboats to Energy Efficient Residences, where they are developing flat-packed green, high design, energy efficient, low cost homes. And they have all of these benchmarks associated with these products that they're building. But they were actually retooling houseboat factories. Somerset, Kentucky was the houseboat manufacturing capital of the world, right? Until the economy tanked. And so they were retooling these factories to build energy efficient homes. And it was a great project, and I got involved with them at some point. I was going to try and launch that as a commercial enterprise.
Did you have to move to Somerset?
No, I wasn't going to move to Somerset or anything. You know, I spent a lot of time in Lexington and, and that area. But that ended up not panning out. I think the project is still going. I think that it just took a much longer period of time than I had available to sort out all of the issues around IP and funding and things like that. You know, so when I started working on it, I needed something that could get up and running pretty quickly. And then I started working on another project to do a sit-stand desk combination, this reclined notion, which I have one today that I work from. I sit for an hour and stand for an hour or whatever, and it's not my own. We ended up not getting any sort of traction with that and spending money on it and not making money from it. And then I had a third thing that I was doing that involved digital insights reporting. So I had been looking at a whole lot of high-traffic websites over the years.
Big data stuff.
Big data. That's a little, you know, it's a little fuzzy.
So I know it is.
I try not to say big data.
I try to impress people by saying big data.
So just taking up different web metrics and helping clients understand what was happening and then providing optimization.
Gotcha.
Right?
Okay.
And so did a lot of that for 2 or 2.5 years, and it was great timing, I think, and really I was able to learn a lot. Make a living, and it was good working with some pretty good clients.
Well, what about the greenhouse? What did that? A personal project?
Was a personal project. Okay. I had actually already started on that when I started talking to the H-Beer folks. So it had to do with sort of an obsession, and that's how I got to them.
Okay.
So I was already convinced that that our house was too big, and that our house was too inefficient, and that people need to live a different way. And I don't mean need like, oh, everybody's wrong if they want a big house or they want big utility bills, but rather that there's a better opportunity for us as a country to build microgrid communities and achieve some sort of degree of energy independence that is onerous to the individual and not just to a government agency or a corporation, right?
Okay.
And so I started doing all sorts of research on it, and I've always been sort of, you know, Chuck and I both have always been sort of amateur, semi-pro real estate investors and flippers and stuff like that. So we had both done a bunch of that. In fact, Chuck tends to own and rent. Hopefully he doesn't mind me saying that on this on the podcast, but he, you know.
He's a slumlord.
He has really nice houses. And then I would always fix them up and sell them. So combining that interest, I got really into this idea of more sustainable building and energy efficiency and started my own project, and now we live in it. And it's been just a combination of like a great thing to do and a nightmare, like most construction projects are.
Sure,
yeah.
I have a basement I need to get framed in, but
yeah, don't call me.
We'll talk about that off mic.
Yeah.
So is there a market for that sort of thing where is the country moving in a direction where they are going to pick up on that sort of thing?
I think that they already have. I think the limitation is most people don't have the ability to build anything, and most builders don't want to do something that costs more money, particularly after what we just came out of economically for builders. Right. You know, builders were wiped out, and they weren't really looking at upside. They were looking at, you know, how can we make a living and continue.
And there are plenty of ways to retrofit an old house with more energy efficient.
There certainly are some really good ones. I mean, we're testing all of my ideas about energy efficiency and heating and cooling right now. It's 0 degrees today. So it's been an interesting, but it's working pretty well.
Is it good that I have frost on the inside of my windows of my house?
Typically, no.
Somehow I think that that's not good.
That's a quality you might pick up in the Highlands or Crescent Hill. Standard.
My house is 40 years old. So,
okay.
Give me a break. So what now? Are you working on a startup now? I mean, it's not, we haven't heard much from you publicly. You don't tweet that often.
Oh yeah. I've been trying to keep up, with Twitter, but I'm more a consumer at this point. Although this was the irony of the whole thing, right? Running Mojo. I was never a big fan of social media. Hmm. I was a fan of the business that we were running and the concept and the ability to reach people and the ability to sell it, monetize it to advertisers, and to grow that, you know, that particular area of technology. But I was never a personal fan of, you know, I mean, the old joke was there was no Keith. I was just a picture that came in Chuck's wallet. Right. Like whenever he had to hand out a decision that people wouldn't be a fan of, it was Keith's idea.
So, hey, you know, you got to divide up the labor somehow. I mean,
that's right.
You know, so I mean, are you involved in the startup scene at all? I mean,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a little bit. Definitely a lot less than I was, and I certainly it has taken a. Well, to answer your first question, I've got a couple products that I'm working on, and those might or might not become startups. You know, my guess is most things that I work on and become, you know, they become projects and not
right.
business opportunities. I'm always working on a few things, but it'll be interesting to see when I get some demos working what, you know, what comes of it and whether
so it's an
traction.
Actual physical sort of thing, or is it a software deal?
No, software deal okay. in this case, in particular, the one that I'm most interested in.
Okay.
Yeah, I realize that as much as I want to design and build products, I really don't have the chops for it. So I'm just not that great at it. So yeah, I'm doing that on the side and was working and consulting pretty actively with a couple of startups, but I'm doing a little bit less of that now. And part of that is because I think the accelerators are starting to fill a space and,
okay.
and pick up some of that. You know, but I also think the, there's a certain irrational exuberance around the whole startup notion right now, right? People are traveling the world preaching startup cities and startup communities and all of that. So, and I'm not trying to steal any, you know, steal anything away from that. It's probably a great thing for all economies, right, to be exposed to that message. But it takes, it's turning into this very boilerplate approach to how you identify opportunities and start them and nurture them, I think. And the whole lean startup, approach, I'm not sold on. Right?
You're not there's a
some,
fan, huh?
There's some good ideas there, but I think it's mostly just BS. And there's a lot of hype around it, and there are a bunch of other
ways
to start.
It's a curriculum that somebody sold.
It absolutely is.
Okay.
You know,
I went through the Lean Startup program. I like, see my plaques up there on the wall.
Oh, you have a certification.
That's right. I'm certified, baby.
Yeah. Well, that's
I'm a lot
that's
leaner
impressive.
On that plaque than I am in real life.
I have poor observation skills.
No,
that
that's
is a fine-looking plaque.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Anyhow, but I mean, so I, you know, I'm hip to that whole thing, but
yeah,
is that right? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a philosophy. It is a way of doing things, but
yeah,
it seems to have somewhat taken over.
I guess. I wouldn't say there's not a lot of goodness going on there. I would say it's not right for everyone.
Okay.
And I think to a large degree, it ignores what type of business you want to end up with. So what I realized is I'm probably much more interested in lifestyle businesses than in having something huge that scales,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, and it's really, it's
I wonder kinda, what the percentage is of lifestyle businesses that pan out and last mm-hmm. versus a startup who is, you know, trying to build to scale and become the next big thing or at least big enough to, you know, trade publicly or have a massive exit or some sort of thing. I'd be interested in what that number is.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've seen a bunch of different stats.
Well, the clearly, only thing you ever see is 50% of businesses fail in the first year.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's just pretty general.
Yeah.
You know, can we get a little more specific about that?
What do you think about the number of people around even just Louisville that are making a living with themselves, one or two employees, you know, a small business?
Perhaps.
And if it gives them the flexibility.
Owning a podcasting empire.
Owning a podcasting empire, doing digital insights for clients, right?
So, that's right.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I've I guess you would be my 84th episode of this. When I first started doing this podcast, I listed out 25 people that I thought I could talk to.
Yeah, and I wasn't anywhere on. I missed the first.
You
three
were not.
Lists.
You were not on that list. But this is also not the first time I've tried to get you in here to talk about this.
That's
stuff.
True.
So it was last May or something. Right when I was getting this thing kicked off.
And I'm here for you and your startup. I've got no desire to hear myself speak, and I'm sure most people don't either.
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
We'll see how that measures out. But I was shocked once I started doing it. I thought I might get maybe 50 episodes out of this or something, but it really does sort of keep feeding itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding new people to talk to, and I've known you for a while, but I don't know. You know, I have the new cats from the Velocity coming in.
Yeah.
In the next several weeks, I don't know who those dudes are, but there some of them are from here.
T-Shy.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, he's awesome.
So when I had him on, I had my little mobile podcaster unit, and the first time I was like, I got this brand new piece of equipment, and the battery went dead 3 minutes into it.
He couldn't stop making fun of you.
I had to.
I'm kidding.
Well, maybe I had to run down to the Thorntons and pick up some batteries. He's probably just shaking his head the whole time.
I think he's surrounded by entrepreneurs that are all hustling, so I think he gets it.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was hustling. I think if I would have been thinking proactively, I would have gone in with an extra set of batteries in my bag or something.
Note to self, spare batteries.
Jeez. But anyhow, I mean, I've been pleasantly surprised by the number of things going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see, and this is just me editorializing, I guess, I'd like to see somebody really bust out and do something that, and what's missing? Why isn't that happening? Like, 2 years into my podcast, some of those people are still operating. Some of them have pivoted off to do other things, mm-hmm. and they've kept the name, and they're doing just something slightly different.
Yeah.
But, wouldn't it be fantastic to see somebody break out and say, Louisville, Kentucky's company is this?
Yeah.
What's holding us back?
I know you wanted me to say this. It's a terrible spot for startups.
Okay.
Louisville is a bad spot for startups, in my opinion.
Because?
And that's not spilt milk, by the way. Like, oh, if we'd gone someplace else, we would have had a successful mojo or whatever. I think it's a tough spot because I don't think there are a ton of people outside of our small technology community that get technology, right? So we don't have a bunch of tech investors sitting around.
Yeah.
We don't have a particularly large market, so it's hard to find talent. It's hard to find, it's hard to find business partners and, co-founders. And it's
easy to find real estate.
It's easy to find real estate.
We got that going for us.
And I'm not knocking that. Obviously, if you're going to have a successful startup, you need a bunch of different ingredients. And, maybe having good lifestyle, family-oriented lifestyle, affordable real estate, and cost of living, those things are a factor. This is not bashing Louisville, but I don't think most startups in Louisville don't have the potential to get big here. Right? We see with Backupify, Rob made the decision to leave. I think that was a good one. And you can point to a bunch of other companies that have had to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's my opinion. And, we met with really good resources at sort of the seed level and angel level. But after that, there was nothing here for us. And I pitched all up and down, Sand Hill Road in downtown San Francisco and everything else. And, and Shasta and Sequoia and American Capital and everybody, a lot of people opened the doors for us, Bay Partners. And what we found was, there's not a lot of interest in traveling across the Rockies, for a portfolio company. You have to be at a certain size or scale or willing to relocate. And in our case, we had Louisville Mojo, right? That was where our traction was. So it couldn't be much more localized than that. So it was a hindrance. I'm not saying every business will fit into that, into that sort of cage where Louisville is a little bit limiting. Certainly, there are some big wins, and Genscape, is one of them, and you can point to a handful of them, and you can point to some of the biggest companies downtown, that were started in the state of Kentucky and go, John Y. Brown, David Jones. Nobody's taking anything away from them. But if you want a technology company, I don't think this is a great place to try and build it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you laid out your case, so, we're just all going to shut it down.
It's over.
Forget it. Well, I'm afraid this our conversation is going to have to come to an end, though.
Oh!
We could do this all day. And I do. I would love to have you and Chuck in at the same time just to relive old times.
I don't go in the same room with him anymore.
Really?
Yeah, the friendship is over.
Okay.
I'm kidding. I love him to death. It'd be great to come back and see him.
Well, then in that case, I'm bringing a video camera. We're going to videotape it.
I think we have
lunch. See who gets the best of who.
Yeah, we have lunch Thursday. You can just come by and join us.
Okay.
Be good.
He's a big dude, but you're small and quick.
I've always been able to get away. It served me well.
If somebody wants to connect with you for one reason or another, how do they get a hold of you? Is it?
Oh, preferably not, but they could just go to my LinkedIn profile and send me a message.
Or Ringa, R-I-N-G-A, on Twitter.
Ringa on Twitter. Send me a DM. You're great.
Not a big tweeter. But anyhow, thank you for coming and sharing a little bit today.
Dan, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.